by first generation, I mean the children of Kronos and Rhea, right? So six males, three females, six total. And now that we're getting into quote-unquote real gods, and by real gods, I mean the gods that are going to be your everyday players in the myths that you're reading, we're going to have to start learning two sets of names, because the Romans called them something completely different than the Greeks did, and you're reading things from both sources, and I don't want you guys to get confused. So, Zeus is Jupiter or Jove. Jupiter is actually kind of like Jove's father, but you'll see it both ways in translations. Poseidon, the Latin is Neptune. Hades is Pluto, which comes from a Greek word meaning wealthy. Hera is called Juno. And actually, in Italy, in Rome, a woman's Juno, which is Juno, was sort of her female guardian spirit, whereas a male's guardian spirit was called Genius, which we pronounce now genius, right? So a genius wasn't someone really smart, a genius was the guardian spirit of a man. So if you haven't got the attendance sheet yet, just put up your hand to make sure that it gets around to you. Alright, I'll ask again in a little while. Alright, Demeter, her Roman name, her Latin name is Ceres or Ceres, if we're going to pronounce it in Latin. And Hestia is Vesta or Vesta in Latin. So if you see any of those names, don't get confused, be able to figure out who they are. I could well ask you, you know, I said every so often I'm going to give you quizzes. I could very well ask you to give me the Greek and Roman names for gods, you know, say which is which. So you should be very, very familiar with these, and you should also be very, very familiar with the other things I'm going to talk about today, which are basically sort of the what each of these gods is in charge of. Okay? So you shouldn't, by the end of the course, even in a couple weeks, you shouldn't be having to think really hard. Who was Hera again? What did she do? What is Demeter's purpose as a goddess? You should just know that without even thinking, as soon as possible. Definitely by the end, but also long before the end of the course, simply because you're going to be reading about them, and you don't want to have to be wondering who these major players are every time you encounter them. So, these guys come into power after they defeat Kronos, their father, and in some accounts after they defeat Typhoeus. Of course, in other accounts, Typhoeus comes much later. Right? So we've already talked a little bit about Zeus's childhood. Remember, he got all of his older siblings had been swallowed by Kronos. Zeus gets spirited away and hidden in a cave that's probably on Crete, but maybe not. Remember, Callimachus says, all Cretans are liars, which is problematic if Zeus is Cretan. There's one more part of the myth that's important, and it's mostly important because of the end product, not because of what happens in this bit of the myth per se. So Zeus gets nursed by a goat, a magic goat, called Amalthea. And one of her horns gives ambrosia, and the other gives milk, or something like that. And when Zeus has grown up and has, you know, sort of reached his full power, he sacrifices Amalthea, because that's what you do with goats, and he immortalizes her by placing her in the stars as a constellation. This is frequently how non-gods and goddesses get immortalized and honored, as they get put into the sky as a constellation. And we'll see this happening again and again. And towards the end of this semester, we'll actually just look at constellations in general for a day or two. But for right now, just talk about Amalthea. And so he sacrifices her and makes her skin into something that's either a breastplate or a shield or just a cloak that goes over his arms, called the Aegis. And the Greeks thought that Aegis probably meant goat skin. They weren't entirely sure. It also might have meant, you know, stormy or something. They thought so. Because it's related to the word for goat. But other than that, this word doesn't show up. So, in any case, we can think of Aegis as probably meaning goat skin, but definitely referring to this one magical object. And it's a magical object because when Zeus shakes it, it makes it thunder. And he's god of lightning and thunder, so this is very important. So it makes it thunder, and it also instills fear in armies if it's shaken over an army. And in art, actually, the one who's usually shown carrying it is not Zeus, but his daughter Athena, because he lends Athena the Aegis frequently. Thanks. And I don't know where the sign-in sheet ended, but whoever has it, if you can pass it. Okay. Who has not gotten this yet? All right, then pass it over that way. All right, so the Aegis, like the lightning bolt, is essentially a symbol of Zeus's ultimate power. Zeus is all about power. It's one of his fundamental aspects, and we can see this both in the myths about him, like what he does in stories, and also in artistic representations of him. So, he is represented usually with some combination of these. Lightning, bolt, holding it, a scepter, a big, long, kingly rod, sitting on a throne, and accompanied by an eagle. These are all visual aspects of Zeus's power. The eagle is the king of birds. So, here's an example where he's holding a lightning bolt and a scepter. Here's the lightning bolt. And in this, he's got his scepter, he's seated on a throne, and he's accompanied by an eagle. What's he holding in his hand? The goddess Nike, victory. So that's another important thing. But Nike is actually more frequently shown with Athena than with Zeus.
Is she always tiny?
Is she always tiny? Well, compared to a giant, giant god, possibly. But actually, you'll see another version of the statue later. This is not so much a replica of, but it's based on a statue that we no longer have, which is the statue of Zeus at Olympia, which was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. It was enormous. Really enormous. How enormous? Well, Nike that he was holding was probably, we think, about human size. So you can see, you know, if you have a little human standing down here, it's Nike size, you can imagine how big this statue was. So in this case, the thought is that Nike probably was the size to represent a human, all the way up there by Zeus. She's frequently shown as being smaller than the gods, than Athena or Zeus, because she, you know, they are sometimes holding her in their hand. But that said, the gods are all of sort of fluctuating sizes. A god can be massive, signifying their power, because all gods are powerful. Or a god can come down to earth and be human-sized and even look human, but you still once you realize that it's a god, you don't want to look directly at them. It's a bad idea. Does someone have a question? Yes.
I've forgotten. Is Nike a god, a child of one of them?
Yes, yes. Nike is one of the children of Styx, actually. But her name just means victory, so she's one of those numerous personifications of a more abstract concept. Alright, moving on. So Zeus is the supreme ruler. And because of his power on a cosmic level, he is the supreme ruler of the universe. He is associated with kings. Because kings have the equivalent of cosmic power on a terrestrial level. Kings are all supreme and everything is under their control. So Zeus is equated with kings. And remember, you read in Hesiod that kings come from Zeus, and you also actually read it again in Callimachus' hymn to Zeus, because Callimachus was quoting Hesiod. Kings are from Zeus. Zeus is also the one who lays down the order of things. He lays down laws and how the cosmos should be ordered. You know, if Zeus said that the sun actually should be over there, then the sun should be over there. But that said, Zeus wouldn't do that. He's not going to change the natural order of things. It's just that he's the one now who is in control and the one who is laying down the law that all aspects of nature must subsequently follow. And therefore, he's also associated with lawmakers and people who deliver justice. So, on a mythological level, this is expressed by the fact that Zeus mates with Themis, and her name means divinely right, or sort of the way things are and are supposed to be. And their children are Eunomia, which means good law, and Dike, not to be confused with Nike, Nike. So, Dike, which means justice, and Eirene, which means peace. So, in addition to these, these are all basically things that are under Zeus's control. This is expressed by the fact that, on a mythological level, he's their father. And in addition to being associated with Dike, he also punishes those who transgress the nature of things. Because transgressing the laws of nature is equivalent to injustice, lack of justice. So do you guys think that because Zeus is the ultimate arbiter of how things are, that means he has free reign to do whatever he likes? Show of hands for no. Show of hands for yes.
Do we think it?
Yeah, do you think it? No, what do you guys think? Do you think that Zeus actually has free reign to do what he likes?
No.
No, and he knows he doesn't too. So that answers the other half of that question. No, he doesn't. Basically, he has the power to do whatever he likes, but if he were to transgress his own laws, that would bring chaos and disorder. And that is something that Zeus is very much against and doesn't want to happen. So, for example, at one point during the Iliad, the epic of the Trojan War, one of Zeus's mortal sons is about to be killed. Zeus sort of debates out loud, oh, I have the power to save him. You know, I'm in this quandary, I don't want my son to die, but I know he has to. And Hera says to him, just in case he might forget his place, Hera says, well, yes, but if you save your son, then all of the gods are going to want to save their sons. And Zeus says, you're right, I can't do it. And so his son dies. Now, Hera's obviously happy about this because Zeus' son was fighting on the side that's opposite to the side Hera was in favor of. But the point is, Zeus knows that he cannot transgress the laws of nature which he himself has set down. Otherwise, his cosmic order won't stand firm. Zeus is also, in addition to being the supreme ruler, he's also the supreme begetter. He fathers lots and lots and lots of children, both gods and heroes, so immortal and mortal. He's the father of all of the Olympians who are not his brothers or sisters. In some versions, he's even the father of Aphrodite. Okay? So if you read enough versions, in fact, you'll find Zeus being the father of pretty much every single god that is out there in some version or other, even the ones that, you know, Hesiod said, oh, that's the child of Nux, that's the child of so-and-so. In some version, somewhere, some tiny little fragmentary version, Zeus is probably the father of this or that or any god. So, in this case, the power of Zeus is his extreme virility. And he's sometimes called the father of gods and men. Because, on a fairly literal level, he is the father of most of the gods and a lot of humans. Or at least the ancestor of a lot of humans. Because humans are, in turn, frequently descended from divine heroes, and those heroes are the children of gods. Either Zeus himself or one of Zeus's children. So, according to Hesiod, Zeus married 7 times. Started out with Metis, intelligence, ended up with Hera. And these are his children by each of them. Don't worry, this will be on Blackboard. In some other versions that are not Hesiod, Zeus didn't actually marry all of these women, but the idea is still there in that these are his legitimate offspring, as opposed to the ones that he went off and had in secret in one way or another. Yes?
So, if Zeus had the seasons with his second wife, and then with his fourth wife had Persephone, who's eating the pomegranate seeds, brought about the seasons, is that to say that before the seasons existed, they just all were sunny and nice, and then
so seasons in this case, it's a translation of the word horai, which does mean seasons. But, so, this brings about the seasons on Earth, in terms of now we go from summer to fall, and from fall to winter, and from winter to spring, and spring back to summer. But that doesn't mean that the idea of the change of time, because the word for seasons can also mean, for example, hours, so hours of the day. So this is more, in some ways, a concept of the progression of time, but also look at their names. Who are these? They're the ones that I mentioned before that are actually good law and justice and peace. So it's not seasons on quite the same literal level as the Earth has seasons. But at the same time, yeah, you know, Persephone eating the pomegranate seeds and having to go up and down between the lower world and Olympus, that's, you know, it's just another version, right? It's another way of explaining why we have seasons. But Zeus has to ultimately be the father of at least the concept of seasons, the personifications of the abstract idea, right?
With Persephone and the seasons, it does. I just got a little bit confused. How are the seasons, like actual seasons, summer, spring, winter, and all of that? Because it talks about how she's with her mother for 2/3 and with Hades for 1/3,
so,
and 4 seasons.
On the one hand, I don't have a good answer for that because you know, it's the Greek concept of seasons, not our own. But we'll also be talking about Demeter or Persephone later, so maybe when we get there we can talk about any questions like that that are related to that myth. But yes, it doesn't make a lot of direct sense. So, Metis, Zeus's first wife, whose name means intelligence, is the daughter of Okeanos, one of the many, 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 many daughters of Okeanos. And she's very important because she is destined to bear Zeus the son who will dethrone him, just like he dethroned his father, Cronos, and Cronos dethroned Uranos before him. So we should recall that each supreme male god of each generation attempts in a very similar way to forestall the next wave of power in which he himself will be dethroned. And what's the general term for this? What do? They suppress. Yes, they suppress something. They each suppress something different, but they all suppress something, usually their children, right? So Uranos suppresses his children inside of Gaia, their mother. Cronos suppresses his children inside himself, trying a different tactic. Zeus, unlike Cronos, and of course unlike Uranos, goes and actually asks advice from Gaia and Uranos of what to do. And they tell him what will actually work. And what will actually work in this case is to suppress Metis inside himself. So not suppressing Athena, the daughter, or you know the son that she's going to bear, or whatever, but suppress Metis. So the source of the child. If your wife isn't there, you can't have sex with her to produce the next offspring, right? So, therefore, his attempted suppression is to suppress the source of the problem rather than the result of the problem. And so one result of this is that Athena, with whom Metis is already pregnant, is born inside of Zeus, and so she must ultimately come out of Zeus somehow, so it's as though she's being born from him. She is Zeus's equal in power. Her non-existent baby brother would be superior to Zeus in power. He never exists. And we'll look at Athena next week. But Metis, as I said, also now can't even conceive that second child. So there's no more fear on that level. And also, the other result is that Metis is now inside Zeus and therefore essentially incorporated into him. Metis, remember, means intelligence. So this sort of intelligence of how to use your wisdom, practical intelligence, is now a part of Zeus, which also helps to give him power on an intellectual level. Yes?
Okay, before she was going to be swallowed, like, she was just okay with it?
Well, no, I mean, there is speculation as to how he might have actually successfully swallowed her. And the main version of the myth is that he managed to convince her by some means to change into a fly, the shape of a fly, and he swallowed her. Has any of you read The Sword in the Stone?
Mm-hmm.
Has any of you seen, if you haven't read it, The Sword in the Stone?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the legend of King Arthur, that's Disney made a version of it, the book is by T.H. White. In any case, in it there's a very similar game. You have two wizards and they play a game, in which they're each changing into different forms of animals and trying to eat each other. And ultimately, one beats the other by changing into a germ. Because you can't change into anything that can defeat a germ, right? So, you know, if you're a shark, then something else could become a whale and swallow you, right? Or if you're a gazelle and can run really fast, then they can turn into a cheetah, which is even faster and is a predator, right? But if you're very, very, very small, then nobody can find you, and also nothing can defeat a germ. This is kind of the opposite. He gets Mantis to become something very, very, very small, and then swallows him. So it's the same idea of changing into a succession of different shapes until one is actually able to defeat the other. Yes?
I'm not trying to poke holes in the...
In the myth? No, I would never try to poke holes in the myth. You might succeed.
But,
go ahead.
But I thought that Zeus had no idea who was going to bear his successor, which is why Prometheus is tied up.
Well?
Because Prometheus knew, right?
Prometheus knew. That's not why Prometheus is tied up. But that's in a later generation. That's a second potential threat to Zeus's power.
Okay.
So we've put aside this one problem that would have been the problem. This is Zeus's wife. And is going to cause problems with her second child. So we deal with that. Much later, and we'll see this in a few weeks, much later, there's another potential threat. And someone else who can see the future has the knowledge of who's going to do this and what to do about it. Yes?
And so he did not know that she was going to be the one who would ultimately bear the son until after he had married her? Because otherwise, then he could have, like, just not, you know, like, stayed away from her.
Well, I don't think that Zeus can ever stay away from a woman. But he could have, I guess, married her off to someone else, which is actually what he does in the second case when this happens. But yeah, I think he, let's assume that he had already married her to try and establish his power base, right? Because she's the daughter of Okeanos. She's the daughter of a Titan. This gives him legitimacy on another level, just like marrying Temis, right? Temis is herself a Titan. So he's basically trying to get legitimate power on all the levels that he can. Let's marry the daughter of the eldest of the Titans. Okay, that gives me one sort of legitimate power. Let's marry a Titan, a previous generation, the sibling of Cronos and Rhea. Gives me another sort of legitimate power, and so forth. Okay? So that's what's going on here. So moving on, and we'll talk about some of Zeus's other wives and children later.
Is that a storm?
Yes. So, Zeus. Why is he the one in power? Zeus, by one view of things, is the one in charge because he's the most powerful. Fine. This is logical and obvious on some level. If you're the most powerful, then you're the one in charge. Fine. And on another level, he's the one who really defeated Cronos and Typhoeus, so he's the one who deserves to be in charge. Fine. But by another view of things, he was in charge because he was the oldest. Now, what did I tell you guys the other week?
He's the oldest.
Right. He is.
He's the oldest because he was out longest.
Exactly. He's the oldest and the youngest at the same time because he was out in the world before his siblings. So they only exist after he releases them from Cronos. So by that, he's the oldest. But sometimes his brothers don't like the fact, necessarily, that he's in charge. So there's another way, another myth.
Could you go back for a second?
Yep. There's another myth in which things were, or at least should have been, more equal. And Zeus and his two brothers, Poseidon and Hades, drew lots to see which of them would rule which bit of the cosmos. So, Tiffany, can you read this for us?
Yeah. Since we are the three brothers born by Rhea and Cronos, Zeus and I, and then the deserve is Hades, lord of the dead men. All is divided among us three ways, each given his domain. I, when the lots were shaken, drew the crazy to live in forever. Hades drew the lots of the mist and the darkness, and Zeus was allotted the wide sky and the cloud and the bright air. But earth and high Olympus are common all three.
So by Poseidon's the one speaking here, and by his view of things, they divided things up equally. And therefore, they should be equal in power to each other. And it also, importantly, envisions a tripartite division between earth, and not earth, between sky and sea and the dead. Okay, those are thought to be three equal and equally boundless, right? The sky is infinite, the realm of the dead is infinite, and we refer to the sea, in fact, as the boundless sea. I mean, we know today that yes, there are boundaries to it, just like there are boundaries to the earth, but to the Greeks it seems that the sea hems in the land, but then the sea stretches on forever. Yes, there were some Greeks that knew the earth was round, but that's irrelevant. It's a question of perception. So they each have a limitless realm of power. Therefore, they should be equal. And this is Poseidon's view, and this, in fact, is also the view of some of Poseidon's children. They think, well, my father is equal in power to Zeus, and therefore I don't have to abide by Zeus's laws. Now, of course, they're wrong, and they get punished for this view. It's never successful. But this is a theme with both Poseidon and his children. Poseidon never pushes it so far that he actually gets punished. But his sons are problematic, as we're going to see in a little while. So you also read a passage for today about a statue of Zeus that had three eyes. Does anybody remember the justification for why this statue of Zeus has three eyes? Does anybody
And then
right,
he could, in the third eye where he saw all, though.
Okay, so one possibility is the third eye sees everything. And the other is that it's this tripartite division, exactly, the three realms, the sea and the sky and the realm of the dead. So there's a Zeus under the earth, and there's a Zeus in the ocean. And so you can address, is the idea, you can address each of Zeus's brothers as Zeus, which is sort of another way of saying Zeus is the most supreme of all of them, because he in some way is also an aspect of Poseidon. He is also an aspect of Hades. It loves.
Can you leave the door open so we get air?
Yeah, it is pretty hot. Why don't we leave the door open? Yeah. Hopefully it'll be not too noisy out there.
Can it wide open?
Sure.
Okay.
Otherwise it might swing closed. So let's move on to Zeus and Zeus's worship a bit more. There are temples. Oh yes.
Does that literally mean that there's a theory that they're all the same person?
Mm-hmm. Especially in later myth and religion. Basically, as we progress through time, there are a number of philosophies and quasi-religions that hypothesize either that all of the gods are really just facets of one god, or alternatively, that, you know, all of the male gods are facets of one god, and all of the female gods are facets of one god, goddess. Sometimes they see this god and goddess as the sun and the moon. There are all sorts of different theories, and they're frequently to do with what someone's philosophical beliefs are. So, for example, there's a philosophy called Stoicism that has the idea that really there aren't multiple gods, there's just one god, and we are all part of that one god. And we need to live according to nature. And the better we live according to nature and the laws of nature, because really nature is that God, the closer we are to being divine ourselves. What that you've read for this class, does that remind you of? The idea of nature being the ultimate divine spirit.
Does it have anything to do with Pan?
No, although that's a good idea. Pan means all, right? There's something that you guys read. Yes.
Ovid's cosmogony.
Exactly. Ovid's cosmogony, remember. He says that what ordered the world and the universe at the beginning, he said, some kindly divinity, or perhaps it was nature. And he attributes then to nature as this divinity. All of the apportioning aspects of the cosmos and separating things out of chaos and stuff. So nature is the rational principle, and really the rational principle is what the Stoics think is supreme. Logos, which means the word, but it also means the reason, the ability to think rationally. So that's Stoicism. So that's, you know, that's one reason, but that's also really not anything to do with this stuff that we're talking about right now. It is in that, for example, this, you read a Stoic hymn to Zeus that addresses Zeus as the one that's over everything and in which everything is contained. You read a little fragment. And so that's influenced by this Stoic philosophy. But we don't, unfortunately, have time for you guys also to like read all of this sort of Stoic thought and to learn about it in addition to the bits of myth that you're reading. Are there any other questions, or should I move on? Okay. So, Zeus has, of course, a bunch of sanctuaries and temples all over Greece, but two very important ones are here at Olympia and up here at Dodona. Now, Dodona is an oracular sanctuary that predates Delphi, which I had mentioned the other week, or Monday or something. It predates Delphi as the most important oracular site of the ancient world. It is an oracle of Zeus, whereas the oracle at Delphi was an oracle of Apollo, who is Zeus' son. This statue of Zeus, Zeus Keraunius, Zeus of the Thunderbolt, was discovered in Dodona. It's much, much, much smaller than this. It's probably about this big. But PowerPoint blows things up. So there was a sacred oak tree there. And the way that you got your oracular responses was in one of a few possible ways. Possibly, it was from the rustling of the oak leaves. You know, the priests interpreted that noise for you. Possibly, it was from the doves that perched in the branches of the oak tree. And that could have been, you know, from their cheeping, or from the way that they move, or anything else, possibly. It could have been from the bronze cauldrons that sat on tripods in a ring around the oak tree that echoed when you struck them. It's also possible that each of these was used at a different point in time, historically speaking. So maybe originally it was from the oak leaf noise, and then later on the priests decided to use the doves because bird watching, you know, that's a popular means of determining the future. And then at some point they started using the cauldrons and tripods. We don't know. So this is all speculation. But because of this sanctuary, oak trees and oak leaves are also symbols of Zeus.
Okay.
And at Dodona, Zeus had a different wife called Dione. And Zeus and Dione were the parents of Aphrodite. But Dione is also just a female form of the name Zeus. So it's possibly yet another way of saying Zeus is the father of everything. And, you know, we even have this sort of female aspect of Zeus that combines with him to produce a child. Yes, Aphrodite was born out of the ocean, but at the same time, Zeus is the father of everything. So let's sort of think of Aphrodite further down this chain of refinement. She's not born from Uranus' genitals, she's born much later. She's a more concrete divinity. She really belongs on Mount Olympus. So let's make Zeus her father as well. Remember, it's not that one contradicts the other. They don't necessarily agree, but that doesn't mean that one is right and the other is wrong. They just both are standing there at the same point. They both exist side by side. And this, you know, the idea of Aphrodite being the daughter of Zeus is a much, well, it's more minor on one level, but at the same time, it's there in Homer's Iliad. When Aphrodite gets wounded, she goes to her mother, Dione, and Dione takes care of her, and Zeus is her father. So, here's a picture of what the donut looks like today. Still has oak trees. Probably not the same ones. I think an old oak tree would have a much thicker stem. Now, moving on to Olympia. As I mentioned on Monday, this was the site of the final battle between Zeus and Cronos. Do not get it confused with Mount Olympus, please. And it's where the Olympic Games were held every 4 years. This is a model of what it looked like. And here's a computer reconstruction of what it looked like. This is the pediment that shows Zeus presiding over some events that happened here at Olympia. We'll get to that myth in a number of weeks. But you know, since what it looks like today is less, no temples, I mean no columns standing and things, it's sometimes nice to see what things looked like probably in the ancient world with color and everything. So every 4 years, Pan-Hellenic Games to Zeus were held here, the Olympian Games. Pan-Hellenic means that people from all over Greece came to participate. They were the most major set of Pan-Hellenic Games in the ancient world. But there were also temples and altars to numerous gods here, not just Zeus. There was also one to Hera, and we're going to be returning to Olympia over and over throughout the semester. This is a reconstruction of that statue of Olympian Zeus that I mentioned. It was built by the sculptor Thaddeus. It was one of the wonders of the ancient world. It's a chryselephantine statue, which means it's made out of gold and ivory. That's an important word. I will, if I can find a pen, I will write it on the board for you.
Stick around for a long time.
Yes, except for when people realize that they're very valuable and nobody cares about these gods anymore. Let's see what we can do.
Right.
Make some money. And things disappear bit by bit by bit. This bit of the word. And so again, we have that little, probably human-sized Nike, maybe even bigger than human-sized. And down here at the bottom, you can't see it very well, but there's a pool of olive oil. And it keeps the statue from drying out. and it also reflects the statue perfectly. So, I mentioned briefly that on the outside of the temple, there were some myths. They were all myths that show the significance of Zeus and his authority over Dike, justice. And they show his punishing, or remind the viewer of his future punishing, because the viewer knows the stories, of those who transgress against justice. Those who lie and cheat. You don't want to do those things, because Zeus will punish you if you do, eventually. Maybe not now, somewhere down the road, or even your children, but eventually it's going to come back to bite you. So let's move on to some of Zeus's siblings. Poseidon was the ruler of the oceans, and he's usually depicted with a trident, a three-pronged spear that's used for fishing. Poseidon uses his trident to stir up the ocean, make it stormy, and to strike the earth and to make the earth shake. And he's often shown with various sea creatures, like this little dolphin, around him. And unlike Zeus, Poseidon only had one wife, named Amphitrite, but like Zeus, he slept around a lot, and had a lot of children. Not quite as much as his brother, but still a lot. And Poseidon's sons, in mythology, were generally pretty nasty pieces of work. They might be cannibals, they might have multiple heads, they might be highway bandits, and beat up anybody who tries to cross from, you know, this town to that town. If you see a fairly human-shaped, not nice guy in mythology, a good bet is that they're a son of Poseidon. They are hubristic. They are monstrous. Lots of monstrous sons. So, physically, the ocean is very powerful. So Poseidon, like Zeus, is very powerful, but the ocean's power is a more uncontrollable power. And Poseidon is therefore associated with that sort of uncontrollable strength. And this manifests itself in a few ways. He creates the horse. And horses, before they're broken to the bridle, they are very much a manifestation of that sort of uncontrollable and wild power. Similarly, earthquakes. They're another manifestation of this uncontrollable, tremendous force. And again, remember, the Greeks are this little island surrounded by the sea. When the earth shakes, when there's a tidal wave, they suffer immensely. So Poseidon and his uncontrollable strength are really a source of concern for the Greeks. Poseidon, as a sea divinity, has a special horse called a hippocamp, which is a horse in the front and a fish tail. They don't work so well on land, so we have different sorts of horses. Here is a temple of Poseidon, as it looked in the ancient world. Temples of Poseidon could be built anywhere. They didn't have to be by the sea, but of course they frequently were by the sea. This one is on a promontory that looks over the ocean at Sunion, Cape Sunion. Again, a computer reconstruction of how it used to look, same from the other direction, and then how it looks today. And this is why sometimes I show you these, because this gives you less of an idea of how it looks, or how it would have looked. Any questions? questions about Poseidon before we move on? So Hades. So Hades, the third brother, was not actually an Olympian god. He did not live on Mount Olympus. He spent all of his time in his kingdom under the earth, the realm of the dead. Like Zeus, he's frequently shown with a scepter to show his kingly power. He can also be shown with cornucopia, which means a horn of plenty. And this is a symbol of fertility and riches. As the ruler of the dead, he's below the earth. The earth is a source both of fertility, like crops growing, and also of riches, for example, mineral wealth, gold, gemstones, right? Precious things that one mines out of the earth. Because Hades' kingdom is below the earth, he is the one who's in control of these, therefore he is wealthy. This is why they call him Pluton, the wealthy one, which is why he's Pluto in Latin.
So cornucopia, I think of as being that giant horn that's usually gushing with fruits.
Right. Well, here it's just not gushing with fruit.
Right. My question being, he doesn't eat fruits per se, does he? So is it just he has it to represent what mortals would want?
So the fruit comes from a slightly different myth. So the cornucopia itself is simply a symbol. It's a symbol of fertility. Possibly because, yes, sometimes it's filled with fruit, but we have to remember that it can just abstractly represent that concept. It doesn't have to be gushing with fruit in order to be a cornucopia. In the stories of how the cornucopia came to be, well, in one case, actually, it was the horn from Analtheia, the goat who nursed Zeus. So you can imagine that given that her horns were providing nectar to Zeus as an infant, that therefore this clearly shows that they are a source of bountiful abundance and nurturing potential. So we don't need them to be filled with fruit in order for that to happen. At the same time, you know, then in the myth, once it gets broken off the goat, then sometimes it gets filled with fruit, because that is visually how we think of the cornucopia usually. And gods can eat whatever they like. I mean, they usually eat nectar and ambrosia, but they can eat anything. Persephone eats pomegranate seeds. Demeter, when she's all upset and wandering around the earth looking for Persephone, she drinks this barley water, right? That's, you know, they can eat whatever they like. It's just not their favorite food. If you could eat the most delicious thing in the world all the time and it was good for you, wouldn't you? Probably. You know, that's how the gods look at it. But they can eat whatever they like. So he's shown with the scepter and the cornucopia. Oh, and also the other reason he's very wealthy is because he is king over the souls of the dead. How many souls of the dead are there? More than a bunch. An infinite number, right? Everybody dies. Everybody ultimately is under Hades' control. So, you know, if you think about wealth in terms of how many people are your subjects, well, Hades is doing pretty well there. Right? And his other symbol is the rooster, which is possibly connected with rebirth. So, you know, the idea that things go under the earth and then maybe possibly are reborn. There were some Greeks that believed in reincarnation and some didn't. So that may be what the rooster is related to, but that one's more iffy. In any case, the rooster is associated with Hades. So, as I said, he's not an Olympian god. And here we have, on the inside of a cup, a drinking cup, in the tondo, this area here, the circle on the inside, is called the Tondo. And you only see it once you're done drinking the wine. So it's like the surprise at the end. Yay, well done, you finished your wine. So here we have Hades and Persephone reclining at a symposium. So somewhere where you would drink wine. Thematically appropriate. On the outside of that cup, we have some of the other gods at a banquet. Specifically here, who's this?
Poseidon.
Good, see, with the trident. And who's this?
Zeus
with his scepter, and Hera with her scepter, and Amphitrite sitting with Poseidon. So it's the gods and their wives, specifically his brothers. On the other side of the cup, we have two more Olympian gods of the next generation with their wives. Hades is on the inside, all on his own. This illustrates very literally the separation between Hades and the other Olympians, or the Olympians. You don't want to call him an Olympian. And we'll come back to all three of these brothers later when we discuss Demeter, because they will all be relevant again. So, moving on to Hera. Hera is Zeus's female counterpart. She's his wife, okay. But she's also the most queenly and royal of the gods. Maybe because she's this one. Chicken, egg. So, Hera is the goddess of marriage. And this seems kind of ironic. Because her husband is like the worst cheater in the universe. Literally. And this is exactly why she takes so much very personal offense at his philandery. Yes, any woman would be very unhappy if her husband cheated on her, but in Hera's case, it goes far beyond that, right? Basically, every time Zeus breaks his bonds of marriage, he is essentially dishonoring Hera and what she is the goddess of. So Hera's role in a lot of myths is to be this horrible stepmother who is basically trying to make life hard for all of Zeus's children by other women. We can kind of figure out why she might be doing that, right? So in mythology, this does seem to be her main role, is to really just take out her annoyance at Zeus on his various children and the women that he sleeps with as well. In religion, she has lots of honors and cults all of her own. And frequently in them, she's actually depicted as a bride. So her marriage to Zeus has a special name, the Hieros Gamos, which means holy marriage. And their union and sort of the Hieros Gamos concept has connotations of fertility, but not their own fertility, rather divine and cosmic fertility. So when they come together, flowers bloom. Can you read this for us?
Thus speaking, the son of Cronos caught his wife in his arms. There underneath him, the divine arc broke into the young, fresh grass and into dewy clover. Crocus and
Hyacinth,
so thick and soft it held the hard ground deep away from them. There they lay down together and drew about them a golden, wonderful cloud, and from it the glimmering dew descended.
So, you see, lots of flowers. This is the visible, physical representation and result of them coming together. So, despite this, you know, lovely fertility, they don't have a lot of children. That's why I said it's not their fertility, it's cosmic fertility. They themselves only have a very few children. Ares, the god of war, possibly Hephaestus in some versions. In other versions, remember, he's Hera's child all on her own. But why would they not have a lot of children.
He's too busy sleeping around.
Well, possibly, but they seem to, you know, be able to get it on well enough when they want to.
She repulses him.
Nope, she is very attractive. She is one of the three most beautiful goddesses. She's the bride. She's not the mother, right? That's not the aspect of woman that she represents. She's the bride. So she's the goddess of marriage. She represents literally the stage of marriage. Other goddesses, like Demeter, are more likely to be the mother. Hera herself represents a particular stage of a woman's life, which is not the stage where you have children. So this is one explanation for why she might not have very many children. Of course she has some, but not a lot. And in fact, the other children she has are Hebe, which means youth, and Eleithuia, who's the goddess of childbirth. Again, an idea that you have to be a bride in order to have associations with childbirth, but then that then comes somewhere else. So here's the Greek mind working logically, again, for some value of the word logically. Hera, remember, she produces Hephaestus in order to get back at Zeus. And this is a really common theme for Hera, is rebelling against Zeus and trying to undermine him. So she frequently does this on little levels and on big levels, sometimes just trying to make his plans not work out. So I think one of your readings today told you about how, you know, Zeus, when Heracles was going to be born, said, oh, a descendant of mine is going to rule over this whole realm. And Hera said, okay, you want to play it that way? Well, it's not going to be your son. It'll still be a descendant of yours. And she sends Eleithuia to prevent Heracles' mother from giving birth to Heracles, while she makes sure that another of Zeus's descendants gets born instead first. Because Zeus says, the first descendant of mine is going to be born today. I mean, the first, yeah, descendant of mine, exactly.
Is there ever an explanation as to why he's named Heracles?
Well, it's kind of ironic, isn't it? Well, Heracles means glory of Hera.
Was there a purpose behind that, or is it just that's telling you things?
Well, he does bring a lot of glory to Hera because all of the labors that he does are things that are, I mean, they bring glory to himself too. He's doing really awesome things. But at the same time, Hera's the one who's making him do them. So you could look at it that way, or you could look at it as just ironic. But then ultimately also, they do become reconciled. So, no, I don't have a good answer for, you know, what was the purpose of the irony or anything like that. But it is definitely worth thinking about the fact that Heracles' name, and we'll come to Heracles in a few weeks, but his name literally means glory of Hera. But Hera isn't too pleased by his existence. So, in any case, Hera's constantly trying to undermine Zeus in little ways and in big ways, sometimes even staging active coups against him. And on the one hand, she's following in the pattern of Gaia and Rhea, each of whom basically undermined their husband's power. But unlike them, she isn't quite successful. Just like Poseidon can't quite manage, even though he thinks he ought to be Zeus's equal, he isn't quite Zeus's equal. And so none of her attempts actually ever is successful. She had two really major sanctuaries, one here at Argos, one here on the island of Samos. And here's a picture of the Heraion, which means Shrine of Hera, or Temple of Hera, at Argos. Here's the one at Samos. Samos. And there's actually a local myth in cult. And by cult, I just mean the practice of religion. Cult doesn't mean like weird, you know, people who all live together in a bunker or anything. That's not what cult means. Cult comes from the word that just means worship. And so it's the practice of worshiping a god in the appropriate fashion. If I refer to a mystery cult, that's a special kind of religious practice that is secret and only available to people who are initiated. But cult just is the normal practice of the same religion, or the Greek religion, yes.
About what year are these temples being built? And also, did the gods go from bounce in and out of strength? Like, for example, there was a time where Hera is predominant, or were all these temples put up at the same time?
They were not all put up at the same time by any means. Sometimes one god seems to be in power or predominant at a certain place, and then later another god comes into power there. We'll see some of that reflected in myth as we go through. For example, at Delphi, Apollo comes into power there. But, you know, it's very, very hard to know simply from the archaeological evidence whether we can be certain that so-and-so was the most powerful god here at this point, and then at another point, another god was. We can put together ideas, but we're missing a lot of fact. And sometimes people come up with really kooky ideas, which are clearly very kooky, and therefore, you know, make one less willing to put 100% faith in another more reasonable sounding suggestion, right? If you can take this evidence that is in front of you and use that same evidence to come up with a kooky idea and a not kooky idea, it's still hard to be positive that the not kooky idea is correct unless you can prove it in other ways using other evidence. Did someone over there have a question?
Do you know within a millennium?
Sorry?
Do we know within a millennium?
We know when these are from. Yes, absolutely. We can date these. I don't know when they're from. I mean, I can look it up, and I should probably, when I have more time, I will put the approximate date of building on these slides, or, you know, the approximate date of painting for cups and things like that. But, so, yes, people know, but I don't know.
Is there any evidence of any temples ever to Hades, or was that something that just wasn't done?
I want to say that the answer is no. You did make libation, you poured out wine to Hades, potentially, and to the spirits of the dead. There are shrines to dead heroes. They're called hero shrines. We'll get to heroes in a couple of weeks. I think, though I may be wrong, I think there were no temples to Hades. Okay, moving on so that we have time to get through all of Demeter, because there's a lot of Demeter. Demeter. So, Demeter is the goddess of grain and the harvest, and you guys read a lot about her for your homework, so you have maybe a better idea of what Demeter does than some of the other gods. Naturally, she's very important for humans. If we don't have her, we have problems. We starve. She does obviously appear in myth sometimes, but the myth that you guys read for your homework is her very, very most important. And that, in case you're a little bit behind on your reading, is the tale of Hades' abduction of Demeter's daughter, Persephone. So what's going on here? Demeter is lawfully married to Zeus. Remember, Hesiod says Demeter was her like fifth wife or something like that, right? His fifth wife. So Demeter and Zeus have a daughter, Persephone, the legitimate child of Zeus. As her father, Zeus has complete and total right to give her away to any husband he likes. This is, you know, how it works in Greece. The father gives away the daughter to whomever he wants. And in fact, so he decides to give her to Hades. And in fact, again, yes, Hades is Persephone's uncle, but this also was pretty standard practice in ancient Greece. If you only have one daughter and you have no sons, in order not to divide the inheritance and pass it outside of the family, you frequently might marry your daughter to your brother, because then the inheritance stays in the family. So this all is totally normal. Yes.
Okay, whenever you said that was like a common practice, do you mean like with humans too?
With humans. I'm talking about when I'm saying like for the Greeks, normal, I mean for humans.
Oh.
Yeah. Exactly. That wasn't considered incest. Yes.
What if your brother was already married?
Well, then you don't. But, you know, if your brother is unmarried, or if your daughter's husband dies, you might marry her to your brother. You know, I mean, any number of possibilities. But it's by no means totally weird to the Greeks that this would happen. And so really, Demeter has nothing to say about this. She might not like it. In the myth, she goes and she sulks for a long time. But she doesn't actually, you know, at the beginning of things, in the myth, in the version that you guys read, she doesn't actually take a stand against it. She goes, she's in mourning, she sulks, but she's not even really looking for her daughter. As soon as she finds out where her daughter has gone, and who tells her where Persephone is?
Helios,
the sun. So Helios lets her know because the sun is up there and sees everything, right? So he knows. So he tells her, like, right up front, oh, Zeus gave your daughter away to Hades. Demeter's pissed off, but she can't do anything about it. And she doesn't really try to do anything about it at that early stage. So, let's see. Eventually she goes to Eleusis near Athens, and you know, she's upset, and they treat her very nicely, and while she's there, she takes care of the baby of the king and queen. How does she take care of this baby? Does anybody remember?
She
treats him very nicely. She puts ambrosia all over him, and she puts him in the fire. And she is trying to burn away his mortality. The ambrosia is also to keep the fire from hurting him, right? But in any case, this is something that she can do. And also, her nursing of this child is in line with her mythical role, and also, I guess, religious role, as the kuratrophos, which means nurturer of children. So there are several goddesses who fill this kuratrophos role. Even Hera very occasionally does, but Hera far less frequently than some of these more mother-like goddesses. So, in any case, she's there, she's at Eleusis, and remember, things go horribly wrong. The mother happens to come in, sees the child in the fire, goes, oh my god! And Demeter takes the child out, drops him on the floor. This is the nice version. This is the friendly, no babies get harmed in the making of this poem version. In other versions, Demeter gets distracted when the mother comes in and the baby burns up in the fire. But at the same time, if you think about it, these are two different expressions of the same fact. The baby does not become immortal and will eventually die. It either happens now or it happens later. So two different versions of the story with ultimately the same moral lesson. That the baby ultimately dies because the mother interferes with what the goddess is doing. Yes, one is a more nasty and sad version. So once Demeter leaves Eleusis, then she withdraws completely from humanity. Because she's angry now, right? Also, she's angry both at Zeus and kind of angry at these mortals for being troublesome. And because she withdraws completely, no crops grow. And this is a basic rule of thumb. If a deity is gone for some reason, either because he's angry, whether mortals or not, just angry generally, or wounded, or whatever, then that god's domain doesn't function properly. And Demeter is the one who's in charge of growing things. So, in any case, this causes disorder in the nice orderly workings of the cosmos. And so at this point, Zeus has to do something. Even though before he didn't actually do anything wrong, yes, he should have told Demeter that he was going to give away her daughter, but that's, you know, his choice. But now he's got a problem, and so he has to do something to solve it. And so, remember, he says, okay, Persephone can come back if she hasn't eaten any food in the underworld. As you probably remember, she did. She ate either one pomegranate seed or several pomegranate seeds. And as a result, yes, she has to spend part of her future time in the underworld, but there's also another significance to her eating of the pomegranate seed, which is that pomegranates are associated with marriage. There have been a number of little clay pomegranate dedications found in Greece. Which goddess do you think they're dedicated to?
Hera.
Yes. Hera. Not Persephone. Not Demeter. Hera. So pomegranates are associated with marriage. In Athens, brides would be given pomegranates. They might possibly have eaten pomegranates at their wedding. So this is a normal symbol of marriage. And so, really, it's just saying that Persephone and Hades, this was an actual, sort of real, legal match. So, Persephone then has to spend part of each year in the underworld and the rest of the year on Olympus with her mom. When she's gone, Demeter is upset and crops don't grow. Winter, right? Yes, two-thirds of the year, I don't know. Anyway. But in any case, this is why we have winter. In order that humans aren't going to starve during this period, Demeter teaches humans, or specifically one human named Triptolemus, how to sow and reap grain. Here's Triptolemus. Here is Demeter holding a bundle of wheat sheaves, which is one of her attributes, and a torch. Here's Triptolemus. He's in Demeter's dragon-drawn flying chariot. He also has some wheat sheaves. Here is Persephone, also with a torch. Behind Persephone, just barely over here, is the figure Eleusis, the representation of the location where Demeter will later establish this mystery cult. And I think I am going to just finish this up next week. We don't have a lot more to get through, but it is time for class to end. So if you pass me the attendance sheet, whoever has it, if you did-